Philippians 3, and looking really at verses 15 to 19 this morning. The Apostle Paul was a very intense man. I think we have to draw that conclusion from the way in which he writes. We, of course, have not met him. We cannot see him or see the way in which he speaks and writes. But we read the Word of God. And Paul wrote what he felt. And we can feel it very often in his writing. Just the language he uses, the figures of speech that he uses, the warnings that he gives, the strivings that he has. And he wants and longs for those to whom he writes. We've been reading and thinking about the race, the Christian race, and the way in which he writes about it. He says, I press towards the goal. There's nothing half-hearted about the Apostle Paul. He's a man of intensity, intensity in feeling, intensity in desire. John Bunyan said, I preach what I feel, what I smartingly do feel. In other words, Bunyan often preached with tears. And we read here that Paul wrote with tears in his eyes. In verse 18, he says, even weeping. As he's writing, as he's dictating this letter, it's being taken by Epaphroditus back to Philippi. And Epaphroditus will say, will tell those people that Paul, when he was writing this passage, was weeping, was crying for them. Not the only time. Read about it a number of times in 2 Corinthians 2, for example, verses 3 and 4. He says, I wrote this very thing to you, lest when I came, I should have sorrow over those from whom I ought to have joy, having confidence in you all, that my joy is the joy of you all. For out of much affliction and anguish of heart, I wrote to you with many tears. I wrote to you with many tears, not that you should be grieved, but that you might know the love which I have so abundantly for you. Why does an intelligent, educated, experienced, courageous apostle weep like that? Why do tears run down his face when he is writing to Corinth or writing to Philippi? Well, he tells us in 2 Corinthians 11:28, he says this, what comes upon me daily, the care, the deep concern for all the churches. That's why we sang that hymn together. Do we really care? We've asked that question before, haven't we? We asked it when we thought about Timothy and Epaphroditus. Do we really care? Or do we just come along? Well, Paul's been thinking about that analogy of the race, hasn't he? In verse 15, he says, as many of you as are perfect or mature, full grown, in other words, those of you who are experienced in the Christian life, he says, have this mind. What mind? Well, the mind of what he's been talking about in verses 13 and 14. And then maybe in verse 16, he's saying to the less experienced Christian, nevertheless, to the degree that we have already attained. In other words, some have perhaps not yet come to a mature Christian faith. He says, walk by the same rule. The original means stay in line. Keep up with the others. We're walking together. We're running together. We thought about that last week. Normally in a race, you're in competition with everybody else. You want to beat everybody else. But in the Christian race, we're here to help each other. We thank God for times like Friday when the men were able to meet together, some of us, and encourage one another. We're to do that in the families of the church. Men to men, women to women, one another. And in verse 17 he says, follow good example. Brethren, join in following my example. And note those who walk so as you have us for a pattern. He's probably thinking of Timothy and Epaphroditus and maybe others in the church in Philippi that Epaphroditus had told him of. And he said, look, there are those who are such an example of living the Christian life. Follow them. As they encourage you, walk alongside them. Run alongside them. They're there to help you. So you see, the apostle felt so deeply about each one, those who were mature, those who were younger and inexperienced in the faith, for everyone. We are to look upon one another in such a way, we're not in competition. Some of us are a long way down the path. Maybe we've read lots of books. Some of us have not read many. Doesn't matter. We're on the same race, going to the same glory. That's what Paul's thinking of here. So it brings us to verse 18. Verse 18, where Paul, out of his real care and concern, comes warning. See, the Apostle Paul loved the churches, he loved this church of Philippi so much that he wanted to warn them. And out of Paul's intensity and tears, we see now why he writes as he does. Why is he writing even weeping? Well, there's one word. If there's a text this morning, it's one word in verse 18. Enemies. Enemies. He's not going to lose the analogy of the race, but he's going to add to it the analogy of the battle. How often the Apostle Paul does that. There's a number of occasions you can perhaps think of them where he's thinking of the battle and the race, and they're almost side by side. He says, when he's coming to the end, doesn't he? He said, I've finished the course. I've kept the faith. It's a race and it's a battle. And there are enemies. Well, we've explained, haven't we, what some of those enemies are. We saw it at the beginning of chapter 3 and the first few verses where he says, beware, beware, beware. Remember that? He's saying, beware of the Judaizers. Those who brought in all the Jewish traditions, all the rituals, all the outward things like circumcision and so on, and said that they were necessary for salvation. And this is why he says right at the beginning of this chapter, rejoice in the Lord. Our focus is upon him, not on all these other things. So that was something he warned them about. But it appears now that he's changing, and he's warning them now about others. It appears that Epaphroditus has told Paul of others circulating in the church and around the church and among believers with a slightly different strand of error, different enmity, if you like. Those who were Judaizers, they were taking the eyes of the Christians off of Christ. And so are these others. And they are what we might call sensualists or libertines. Now, it doesn't matter really whether we remember Judaizers and these other words, sensualists and libertines, because it's what they teach and the influences that they bring. That's what we really need to see. Because in our day, today, this sort of teaching and this sort of influence is very prevalent. And we need to be warned too. This is a living word. These words are written for the people in Philippi, but it's God's word to us today. As we come to church each Sunday morning and evening, we're coming to hear what God has to say to Castlefields Church here and now. We saw on Wednesday how the angel of the church is in God's right hand, the messenger. When someone comes to preach, they are bringing God's word to God's church. So we have to listen carefully. Just as I'm sure Epaphroditus said to those at Philippi when he took this letter back, listen carefully to what Paul has written. And here are four telltale signs. Four telltale signs of this teaching those who were sensualists, libertines. They're here in the verses. Verse 18, first of all, first sign, first telltale sign of this influence, of this teaching. Opposition to the centrality of the cross of Christ. Opposition to the centrality of the cross of Christ. Verse 18. For many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you, even weeping, that they are enemies of the cross of Christ. This is one of the telltale signs of this teaching. Now, before we just think about that and apply it in an up-to-date way, we need to understand, why is it that Christians, that Bible-believing Christians, make so much of the cross of Christ? Why is it that the cross of Christ is central? Why is it therefore so serious when any teaching comes to remove the centrality of the cross of Christ or shift it to one side, take our eyes off of it? Let me just give you three things. First of all, because of the sinfulness of sin. Why do we make so much of the cross of Christ? Because of the sinfulness of sin. That sin is so awful, so insidious, so all-encompassing, so deeply penetrating, that our forefathers put together a phrase of how sin affects mankind. You may know it. It is the total depravity of man, of all men. Out of the scriptures it says, there is none that doeth good, no, not one. The total depravity of man, that the effects of the fall into sin in Genesis chapter 3 have affected every man, every woman, every boy, every girl. Spoilt, tainted, polluted, and touched every part of life and thought and action. Not that everyone is totally depraved. We don't believe that, but we believe that the total depravity of man means that every man, everywhere, at every time, in every part of their life, is tainted and touched and polluted and spoilt by sin in some degree. So there is none righteous, none pure, none perfect, no, not one. That's the sinfulness of sin. Secondly, because of the inability of man to save himself from the consequences of being a sinner. Total depravity means total inability. That we are dead in trespasses and sins. We cannot move, we cannot live, we cannot do anything to save ourselves. So every man, everywhere, in every time, is unable to do anything to save himself. And then thirdly, because of the love of God in sending Jesus Christ to be the Saviour of sinners at the cross. That's why we make so much of the cross, because of the depravity of man and the inability of man, and the fact that Jesus Christ said, I am the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. There was no other good enough to pay the price of sin. He only could unlock the gate of heaven and let us in. That's why we sang this morning, come, let us sing of a wonderful love, tender and true, out of the heart of the Father above, streaming to me and to you. Wonderful love. at the cross. The cross of Jesus Christ. Now we make much of the cross because we make much of Jesus Christ. It's his cross. The salvation that was brought, that took place. When I surveil a wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss. That's what Apostle Paul said, isn't it? Pour contempt on all my pride. Now then, the Apostle Paul, when he is thinking of those who are teaching the Philippians and who are coming into the Christian church today and are saying such things as this, he is weeping. Sin is not all that bad, surely. It's unreasonable, isn't it, to say that everyone is so unable that they haven't got anything to bring to God. What about our self-esteem? That does nothing for self-esteem. Surely there's more to life than just constantly thinking about your sin and emphasizing it. Doesn't it say in the Bible that Jesus will forgive sins? If you slip a little, doesn't matter, surely. Because he's faithful and just to forgive sin. Come on, blend in. Join in. Enjoy life. Live a little. Anyway, a Christian is not any great difference, is he? Is she? To the world? See, there are teachings today, as there was in Paul's day, which do not emphasize a Christian distinctiveness. Remember, opposite directional Christianity. We are going in the opposite direction to the world. The sensualist, the libertine, says, no, just let the world carry you along and be like it. Paul wrote in Romans 6, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid. So here were these people opposing the centrality of the cross, because what they were saying was, sin's not really that bad. Man has got some ability. And it's not just the love of God, it's my goodness that counts as well. Beware. Secondly, here is the second telltale sign of this type of teaching, an emphasis on sensual appetites. We just mean the senses, don't we, when we say that word sensual? On the senses, touch, feel, handle, taste, see. An emphasis on sensual appetites. Verse 19, whose God, small g, whose God is their belly. This is one of these verses or phrases that as a child, as a young person, used to go to church or sit, and when this was read, I used to chuckle a bit. I used to think of this big fat chap, you know, eating his McDonald's, double cheeseburgers, and his fries. Well, some truth in that, you know. Because the word belly in the Greek is the word gaster. Right? We speak about gastronomy, don't we? If you have a bit of a bad tummy, you might have gastric flu. You see, Paul is speaking literally about the belly. And if we explain to Paul, if Paul was here today, about the gastro pub, you see them, don't you, sometimes? Eat as much as you like. It's very sad, isn't it? St. Werburgh's Church, the biggest Chinese buffet in the Midlands. And what Paul is saying here is that the teaching of these people is that just having what you like and as much as you like and enjoying it. Eat, drink and be merry. I used to drive into Birmingham and on Broad Street I turned off to the car park for the office, and as you turned off there was a pub and a nightclub, and it said this: eating, drinking and cavorting. That's what was being advertised. Say, come on in, just have a great time. Eat as much as you like, drink as much as you like, do what you want to do. Now, we're not saying that you shouldn't go out for a meal. We're not saying that the elders will be checking every restaurant and seeing if you're in Wokmania. Of course not. It says here, whose God is their belly, right? God is that which we worship. In other words, we, our attention, our time, our thoughts, they all go to things that are going to give us pleasure, touch the senses. Oh, we love a good meal, of course we do. We love fun and enjoyment, of course we do. There's nothing wrong in those things in measure. But you see what Paul is saying here. The emphasis is on the body. The God is the belly, the God is the body, not the soul. It's the needs of the soul that are getting ignored because of the appetites of the body. There's an imbalance. And there is a teaching which comes into churches, into Christian circles, which can take Christians away from that balance. And it is wonderful that Christians go out together and enjoy one another's company and everything else. Of course it is. But we've seen it and we see it that they are emphasizing, there's an emphasis on things which are taking young people and other people away from the centrality of the cross of Christ and away from the God who deals with our souls. That's our primary need. That's our primary requirement. What are those appetites? Food and drink and pleasure and entertainment and sexual gratification, physical things, everything that the city provides. Go and take it without measure. Go and worship it. Give time and attention to it. Well, the hymn writer says, oh, let me feel thee near me. The world is ever near. I see the sights that dazzle, the tempting sounds I hear. My foes are ever near me, around me and within. Oh, Jesus, keep me near thee and shield my soul from sin. The Apostle Paul, he's thinking and he's weeping. He's told them before. He's told them often. He must have told them when he was there about these things, and he's telling them again. And you might say, well, we know all these things, but we're telling it again because we need to hear it. We need to be reminded of it because the devil is a subtle foe. Thirdly, here's a third telltale sign of this type of teaching. Glory in shameful things. Glory in shameful things. Again, verse 19. Whose glory is in their shame. Or who glory in their shame. Glory in shameful things. What is he speaking about? What sort of things? Well, we read together, didn't we, in 2 Timothy chapter 3, that in the last days, in these days, the days in which we live, there will be men and women who come and even bring into the church things like this: lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, and so on and so on. That list goes on. And you see, that is the world today in which we live in, isn't it? You only have to turn the pages of the paper. You only have to put on the news and to realise what days we are in. And the interesting thing is that there's a glory in the most shameful things. I guarantee you pick up a paper tomorrow, and in the paper somewhere there'll be something about Big Brother. Now, if you don't know what Big Brother is, don't bother finding out. But if you do know what it is, it's just voyeurism. But the national papers will be reporting what's going on inside some house somewhere where there's cameras watching every move. Disgusting things. And there's a glory in it. Shameful things. What about the national lottery? Preachers love to have a pop at the lottery, don't they? But what is it? It's just taking the money which we have and gambling it away. And people win millions of pounds who've never earned it. It's shameful. We thank God for the money we have. We thank God for what we earn. We work hard to earn it. And long, some of us. Some of you have done long days and long weeks. And we thank God for the money. But there's a glory in it. Isn't there a glory in this shameful thing? And there'll be a gay pride march in cities all around the country. And there'll be pictures in colour. There'll be a glory in it. Shameful thing. Gone are my days playing on the PlayStation and everything else. My boys thankfully have gone past that. But we used to play on the PlayStation, and I always used to lose. But you know, there are things on there. You know this Grand Theft Auto? You know, it's the biggest grossing game in the world. Bigger than some of the biggest films. And we read what the films gross, don't we? Millions upon millions of pounds. And here are young people all round the world playing on a PlayStation, an Xbox or whatever it is. Grand Theft Auto. What's it all about? It's all about violence. It's all about stealing. It's all about things which are anti-society. And there's a glory in it. They're shameful things. We walked through Birmingham last night about 10 o'clock. And Anne said, as we went down an underpass, "Are you sure you know where you're going?" Because being in a city on a Saturday night is not a good place to be. But you know, all through the week, people will say, "Coming out Friday? Coming out on the town?" And on Monday morning, I've been there, I've been in the office, I've heard it said, "Oh, I got smashed on Sunday. Got wrecked on Saturday." There's a glory in it. Now you may say, "Well, wait a minute. I've never gone that far. I would not buy those things. I would not do those things." No, but every time you switch on the television, every time you switch on the internet, every time you go to the cinema, every time you go out, wherever you go, you must understand that the devil is such a foe that he's enticing you nearer to these things. And for you to glory in them too. And to you to laugh at them. And for you to say, "Well, it's okay." Instead of standing up and saying, "That's shameful. That should never be." And it's so easy in our minds for these things to become acceptable. Then they become acceptable in the family. They become acceptable to our children. They get louder and louder. That's why the hymn writer says, "Oh, let me hear thee speaking in accents clear and still, above the storms of passion, the murmurs of self-will." Now, I don't know what was happening in Philippi in those days, but we do know that this teaching was creeping into the church. And Paul was weeping because of it. Sensuality. Opposition to the centrality of the cross because of sin's not that bad. Emphasis on sensual appetites, a glory in shameful things, and lastly, fourthly, an earthbound mindset. Verse 19, again, who set their minds on earthly things. And here it is again, that word, the mind. The men who met together on Friday, we did think of this. Richard brought a book and was telling us about how the mind is the central thing that the devil will go for. Because if you can get it into your mind, so you turn it over, and you think about it, and you visualize it, you know what you'll do? You'll do it. What's in the mind? You'll do. We were thinking about that man who murdered his wife and his young child. And we now know, don't we, because of the trial. You've been on the internet. How to kill someone without leaving any evidence. He trawled the internet for sex. What was in his mind? He did. We're going to think about that in chapter 4. Paul is going to say, think on these things. What things? Things that are pure, noble, right, true, just. It's a battle on. You've got to think about the things you're thinking about. And you switch on the TV and you hadn't got a moment's thought about this perverse thing. But there it is. And you're thinking about it. And you're messing about on YouTube or something like that. And there it is. You go in the newsagents. Whatever it is. See, the devil wants to just hook your mind. Once he's got your mind, he'll have you doing it next. Paul knew that. Paul said that this teaching is earthbound. The mindset is earthbound. So there are those who come into the church and bring our minds down to earthly things rather than lift our minds to heavenly things. You know, if you're always thinking about things or schemes, you've got some scheme for the house, you want that particular car, you're going to go there and do that. You can find yourself, can't you, at work? Somebody will say, "What are you thinking about?" Oh, no, nothing. Penny for your thoughts, my grandma used to say. Very often you wouldn't want to pay a penny for the things that you and I are thinking about. And you see, if you start thinking and then doing earthbound, you'll slow down in the race. Our interest in Christian things will wane. We'll stop reading Christian books. We won't bother going to the prayer meeting. We won't bother reading, praying at home. The prize of the upward call of Christ, it won't be so precious anymore, because we're not looking up, we're looking down. and the things of earth become precious. And Paul's weeping because he's thinking of Christians who have taken their minds off of Christ and have become earth-bound. So he's going on, and we'll see it next week, to say, look, our citizenship, verse 20, is in heaven. That's where we belong. Our place, our love, our affection, our things, they're above, not beneath, not on the earth. That's where we're going. And he is so sad that there are Christians who have a mindset which is earth bound. We mentioned Pilgrim's Progress on Friday. It's not surprising, is it, a group of people get together and talk about books. Pilgrim's Progress is bound to come up. And you know, Christian and faithful on their journey, they come to a city, to a town called Vanity. And there's a fair. And Bunyan says, it's not a new fair. It doesn't just come and go like some fairs in the town will do. It's there all the time. And it's a thing of ancient standing, he says. And it's this fair where we must pass through unless we go straight to glory. That's what Bunyan says. Now, as I said, the way to the celestial city lies just through this town where this fair is kept. And he that will go to the city, the celestial city, and yet not go through this town, must needs go out of the world. So he's saying this, as a Christian, you will go through this teaching, this influence, this fair. Don't think you won't, because you will, we all will. Because Jesus Christ went through this fair too. And we know what happened to faithful in Vanity Fair. Or do you? Because if you've not read it, you won't know. So you have to come and ask me.